In just a few years, what used to be an immobile piece of living room furniture, which one had to sit in front of at appointed times in order to watch sponsored programming on a finite number of channels, morphed into a glowing cloud of screens with access to a near endless supply of content available when and how viewers want it. With this phenomena, now a common cultural theme, critic and film historian David Thompson looked to write a cultural history of the six-decade television era. His book, Television, A Biography, presents over 22 thematically organized chapters where Thompson brings us provocatively insightful and unique voices to the life of what is television. David Thompson is a film critic and frequent contributor to The New York Times, The Guardian, and more. He is the author of the Biographical Dictionary of Film, now in its sixth edition, and Moments That Made the Movies. It's a great pleasure to welcome David Thompson to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
A great pleasure.
After writing so much about film throughout your career, what brought you to want to write a biography on television?
A large part of it was the realization that has been growing in the last 15 or so years that the most interesting and impressive movies made in America were actually being made for TV. I think that the thing we call long-form series, by which I mean stuff like The Wire, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, many, many others, those really are the movies that I have valued the most about America and coming from America in that time period. So, you know, it seemed to me that television had effectively, at last, taken over from the movies. I think the movies are in a very sad, parlous state at the moment, whereas TV, as I think many people would agree, is in a kind of golden age. So that prompted me. And, of course, once I got into it, I realized that I've been a movie person. But what that really means is I'm someone obsessed with moving imagery. And I had been watching moving imagery on the television screen for as long as I've been watching movies in theaters.
It's fascinating in the book how you decided to break it up. This is not a chronological history. Give us a sense of how you decided to tell this story, to create a biography of this medium.
Well, you know, I realized that it would be quite impossible in one volume, even a fairly plump volume, to include everything. So that a first principle was that this is a selection, and I admit that up front. And once you've got that point of view, then I think it becomes more interesting to tackle subjects and themes. And there are matters to do with the medium itself, the technology, what it does to us, how it expects us to watch or not watch, what it says about being attentive, things like that, that are very interesting. And then from that section, I move on to subjects or themes or messages. For instance, the way the police have been treated on television, the way comedy is treated. So I thought, and I hope still, that that way of doing it gives the reader a sense of this entire medium that has been going on most of their lives, and which allows the book to include some things, but not everything, because if you were to include everything, the book would be just a list.
So with that said, there are some 21 organized chapters thematically, and looking at this 65-year-long television era, at what point do you think that we as a culture realized how important television would be and could be?
Well, the honest answer to that, in my opinion, is that we only really saw what was happening, I think, when the Internet came along. The Internet, I regard as an extension of television, a massive geometric progression in that it means we're looking at screens virtually all the time we're awake. Now, we're still grappling with what the Internet has done to us, and in my opinion, attitudes to the internet had a great deal to do with the election we've just gone through. But I think for a long time, people thought, oh, well, the TV is really just a domestic extension of the movies or of theater or of storytelling. And that was true, but the technology had different meanings in it, I think. And it was only when the internet came, when clearly we were exposed to a kind of chaotic electronic world, that I think we saw what had really been happening. And in a nutshell, I think we once thought we were watching particular shows, and now we realize more and more that we're watching screens. And that changes our relationship to reality.
You start off in the book by, it's called By the Numbers. And basically it is about that, about how many screens we have available to us and how that has changed over time. Talk a little bit about how television became so pervasive, as you illustrate in the book at the very beginning, of how every hospital, every hotel, every home suddenly has the television.
When television began, it was an extraordinary focal point for community. The first time I really saw television seriously was in England in 1953. My grandmother bought a television, the first in our family, to watch the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, who is still queen. And I went over to her house, and many members of the family were there, and many friends were there, because most people didn't have a TV set yet. And it was a kind of day-long party. My grandmother made sandwiches and tea and beer for people, and there was a lot of talk. People weren't necessarily watching the screen all the time. But television was like that at first. It was a wonder, a sort of domestic toy, but a place you could sit around, rather than in the way perhaps people had once sat around the piano and had sing songs. Now, that lasted for a while, and this book has some really, I think, enchanting photographs of families just watching TV in that kind of situation. And then we became more prosperous and more sophisticated, and the kids, perhaps, in the family didn't want to watch TV with the parents, so they got their own TV up in their bedroom. And as a medium, television fragmented, and people started watching alone much more. Now, television had always catered to people who were living alone, and it was sort of advertised as that. But now you saw families beginning to break up. And of course, in the last 20 years, with the computer screen, with iPhones and everything like that, that process has just gone crazy. And in my opinion, it could lead even to a way in which we have screens inserted in our own heads. I think that there could be a way one day. It sounds like science fiction, but you have to trust that the technology is going to explode more and more. I think that the nature of the screen and our relationship to the screen, that is becoming more and more important.
You write in the book early on about a new age of television people, and there's a couple things I want to get to about this chapter, but you write an awful lot about Lucille Ball, about Lucy and Desi, and of course Fred and Ethel, and how they became so iconic to us. Talk a little bit about I Love Lucy and its impact and the becoming of television people.
There were other shows that had a similar impact. Milton Berle did, for instance. But I Love Lucy was, I think, really the first huge event on TV in taking a family situation, hyping it up, turning it into melodrama and farce, but making it a family situation that the audience believed was part of their own life. And of course, the show played off the reality of Lucy and Desi to a considerable extent. But it was a show that demonstrated that a television comedy, half an hour, no more, could become an essential part of the everyday life of audiences. And, you know, what's so interesting about it is that Lucille Ball had been in movies, and she'd been fairly successful in movies, but she'd never really quite made it. She never got to the highest level of stardom. But on television, in really a very short space of time, and one that lasted for decades, she became an institution. And television, at the beginning, made people into institutional figures, familiars, people we trusted and liked. Johnny Carson is one, Walter Cronkite was one of them. And, you know, coming right up to date, for good or ill, and it's a very mixed bag, Donald Trump is a TV person. It remains to be seen whether he is more than a TV person. But that's why he's where he is now, because of a strange rapport that he, the television screen, and the audience have. He works on TV, and that has now become a pinnacle of political success. It's a frightening situation, I think. We'll have to see how it works out.
You have a quote from Bill Maher in your book, "If I Don't Want My President to Be a TV Star." It is something that we obviously are grappling with, and I guess have been grappling with for quite a long time. Many people have talked about that idea of a great author can write book after book and hit a very small, significant, but a small audience, and suddenly when you're on television, everybody knows who you are and everybody knows what's going on. And that really does talk about the power of that medium, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, we like to think in the first half of the 20th century that film stars were all important, and film stars were very important in those days. But it was clear within just a few years of television coming in that the people who worked on television, who succeeded, the people who were liked by the public, they had a power way beyond anything else. And just in 20 years after the end of the Second World War, the presidency changes because the president just has to be someone who works on television. And in the very significant debates between Kennedy and Nixon in 1960, you can see the clash between an old-fashioned political figure and a person who simply functions on TV. And we've never got over that, and I don't see there's any way we can get over it.
You write in the book about formulaic television. Where do you think we are in that? And in some way, shape, or form, will we always have formulaic television?
Yeah, I think so, because I think that anything that works gets repeated. And, you know, you can argue that even in the best long-form TV series, once the series gets established, the people making it don't want it to end. They don't want it to have a dramatic narrative conclusion such as you might anticipate. They want it to go on forever because it's a huge commercial machine they're riding, and they want to make the best of it, so that a show that might have been canceled in season one or season two quickly gets into a state where it's going to go to six or seven seasons and then go into syndication and box sets. And the nature of narrative changes then, because you have a story that you really cannot bring to a conclusion.
I'm curious as to what you make of binge watching, of that idea of, instead of waiting for every Monday night at 9:30 to watch MASH, that you now can watch all, 12 seasons of that program in a week.
Yeah, well, it's an extraordinary opportunity, facility, and people clearly take advantage of it. I remember, for instance, watching Breaking Bad as it played on AMC over the years, and I would miss the occasional episode, and it had advertisements in it a lot of the time then. And I liked it. I thought it was very good. But then years later, I sat down with the whole thing, box sets, over a long weekend, and I realized that it had a power and a cohesion much greater than I had anticipated before. So that I think the level of respect you have for some of these shows changes in binge watching. But we're losing what I think is a quite precious thing, that the feeling that you go out and you meet someone on the street and they watched what you watched last night and they're full of a need to talk about it. I still love watching something at a certain time on television. Recently this year there was a series called The Night Of, which played initially on Sundays at 9 p.m.
Right.
I just had to be there at 9 p.m. I couldn't wait to see it streaming the next day or so. It's like that feeling with sport. I would give anything, for instance, to be there watching the Super Bowl as it happens or Game 7 in the World Series. And I'm not really interested in watching it a day later, which is a facility that television offers, but I don't really want to do that. I want to see it live. I still think there is something vital about a live event on television. After all, a few nights ago, most of the nation sat for hours on end, hooked on a TV set, bringing the results gradually. You wouldn't dream of watching that again a week from now. Mm-hmm. It had to be in the moment. And there are things that need the moment, and I think the audience loves that quality to them.
David Thompson is the author of Television, a biography. A great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Television, a Biography. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.